Something Wicked starts in 5, 4, 3.
Presenting ourselves as the perfect couple, because we don't want to get into that bag either, right? Because we're trying to present what it is, you know, a relationship that lots of other people are having, but they're maybe not songwriters and they don't express it that way. And the letters we're getting back are from couples, apart from the kids who just like it as music. The main excitement is the letters from people who are married with kids, or not necessarily married, but relating together and realizing that we're not selling ourselves as the perfect couple. We have our problems. We've had our problems. No doubt we'll have problems. But, you know, we're trying. We want to stay together. We want to be a family. And that's the kind of level we're relating to. I am not aiming at 16-year-olds. If they can dig it, please dig it. But when I was singing and writing this and working with her, I was visualizing all the people of my age group from the 60s.
That's true.
Being in their 30s and 40s now, just like me, and having wives and children, and having gone through everything together, I'm singing to them. I hope the young kids like it as well, but I'm really talking to the people that grew up with me. I'm saying, here I am now. How are you? How's your relationship going? Did you get through it all? Wasn't the 70s a drag, you know? Here we are. Well, let's try and make the 80s good, you know? Because it's still up to us to make what we can of it. It's not out of our control. I still believe in love, peace. I still believe in positive thinking. When I can do it, I'm not always positive. But when I am, I try and project it.
Well, overall, we're getting more and more positive, aren't we?
Because we survive. That's the thing. You have to give thanks to God or whatever it is up there, the fact that we all survived. We all survived Vietnam or Watergate or the tremendous upheaval of the whole world that's changed. We were the hip ones in the 60s, but the world is not like the 60s anymore. The whole map's changed and we're going into an unknown future, but we're still all here. We're still, while there's life, there's hope. Football players are doing it, right? Which we were doing then, which is projecting the future in a positive way. Now, people are saying, no, you're naive, you're dumb, you're stupid. Okay, it might have hurt us on a personal level to be called names, but what we were doing, you can call it magic, meditation, projection of goal, which business people do. They have courses on it. The footballers do it. They pray, they meditate before the game. They visualize themselves winning. Billie Jean King visualizes every move on the court. What we were doing, we were early pioneers of that movement, which is
to project a future which we can have goals which we can reach. Right? People project their own future. So what we wanted to do was say, let's imagine a nice future. She's right. The males like even Aldous Huxley and George Orwell, who produced 1984, you look into Orwell's life, it was all torture and this, that and the other, and he was brought up in a certain environment in a male-dominated society full of Marxist stuff about Spain, and they were all from the third, whatever, that period when they had those dreams of socialism answering everything, right? And their dreams fell to dust after the war. And then they wrote these books projecting this horrific Big Brother monsters controlled by robots. And even now, these people that project the space fantasies are projecting war in space continually, with women in miniskirts, available sexual objects, and the men with super macho John Wayne guns on their hips. I'm saying it's time for the people to get hip to that, man, because they're projecting our future. Do we want to go, our children to be out in space, or grandchildren fighting, maybe not Russians, but Venusians in space? You see, if it works for a football player and a tennis player, it can work for all of us. We have to project a positive future. I think that's what Christ and Mohammed and those people were saying in their way, in their time, for their society. When I do go through that terrible insecurity of the world is collapsing and going crazy, it doesn't make sense anymore. Wouldn't it be easier if I was just along with these people, this few hundred or few thousand that all think the same way, and it makes life easier like that? People realize that it's not the end of the world. The apocalypse is not going to happen, no matter what some person might threaten us with. Those people have been waving those end of the world. I remember the end of the world is nigh cartoons when I was 12, you know. My whole generation, our whole generation was brought up with the H-bomb. I remember Bertrand Russell and all the H-bomb, and the reason that we were rock and rollers apparently in the 50s was because the bomb might go off any minute. You know, I mean, I don't think that's going to happen. I really don't think it's going to happen. In retrospect, if I was trying to say that same thing again, I would say the people have the power. I don't mean power of the gun. They have the power to make and create the society they want. We all created this together. It wasn't a few kings or a few generals. We might have invested the power in a Napoleon, or the Germans might have been hypnotized by Hitler. Does that make the Germans different from the rest of the human race? No way. You know, it could have happened anywhere. It just happened there at that moment in time. Okay? And also, the world, we do breathe in and we breathe out. So you go to the left, you go to the right. It's in the long term, it's meaningless. Even since I was a conscious of politics, it was the right in the 50s, the left in the 60s, and sort of nothing in the 70s. And it's going to the right. If everybody's going to panic and just react to an illusionary right wing that's going to kill everybody, well, that's what you're going to get. I believe that it doesn't have to be like that just because the guy has a right wing or has a different political view than other people. Now, personally, I've never voted in my life. How do you like that? And there's a Beatles book that was handed out on the 1964 tour, a book of photographs, and on the top of it, it shows this young John Lennon in his usual big mouth way, saying, "No phony politician's ever going to get through to me." Well, I take the phony politician out, because I don't think all politicians are phony. I don't think all... I won't categorize even politicians now, because I've learned a lot since I was 23. But I don't think politics is the only answer, you see. I think this idea that we elect these leaders and then expect them to do miracles for us. Now, Kennedy is a big dream for everybody because he didn't live to fulfill or let us down. And it's not to negate what Kennedy was and what he means to people. But the reality is, had he lived, how do you know how well he would have done at the time, right? Or how the war would have gone and how everything would have gone. So investing leaders with supernatural powers, whether they be pop stars, politicians, or movie stars, or football heroes, it don't work. It just doesn't work. Because we put them up on the pedestal and immediately we want to knock them off. So Reagan's going to go in there. All the so-called rightists are all going to be waiting for him to do what they want. And when he doesn't, because it's impossible, because the presidency is such a vast, awe-inspiring position for any man to be in, and it means a lot more than some local right-left group, that he cannot possibly fulfill the dreams of the right wing, the same way as Carter or Kennedy could never fulfill the dreams of the left-wing. People are believing in projecting their own power, visualizing goals, visualizing positiveness, and doing these things that
are changing
the world. It all takes time. You see, I think that the bit about, you know, the 60s, we're all full of hope, and then everybody got depressed, and the 70s were terrible. That attitude that everybody has, that the 60s was therefore negated for being naive and dumb, and the 70s is really where it's at, which means, you know, putting makeup on and dancing in the disco, which was fine for the 70s. But I don't negate the 60s, I don't negate the 70s. The seeds that were planted in the 60s, and possibly they were planted generations before, but the seed that whatever happened in the 60s, the flowering of that is in the feminization of society, the meditation, the positive learning that people are doing in all walks of life. That is a direct result of the opening up of the 60s. Now, maybe in the 60s we were naive, and like children, everybody went back to their room and said, well, we didn't get a wonderful world of just flowers and peace and happy chocolate, and it wasn't just pretty and beautiful all the time. And that's what everybody did. We didn't get everything we wanted, just like babies. And everybody went back to their rooms and sulked, and we're just going to play rock and roll and not do anything else. We're going to stay in our rooms, and the world is a nasty, horrible place because it didn't give us everything we cried for. Right? Crying for it wasn't enough. The thing the 60s did was show us the possibility and the responsibility that we all had. It wasn't the answer, it just gave us a glimpse of the possibility. And the 70s, everybody's going, nya, 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 nya. And possibly in the 80s, maybe everybody say, okay, well, let's project the positive side of life again. You know, the world's been going on a long time, right? It's probably going to go on a long time. Now, I'm 40, I want to talk to the people my age. I'm happy if the young people like it, and I'm happy if the old people like it. I'm talking to guys and gals that have been through what we went through together, the 60s group that has survived the war, the drugs, the politics, the violence on the street, the whole shebang, that we've survived it and we're here, and I'm talking to them. And the woman song is to Yoko, but it's to all women. And because my role in society, or any artist or poet's role, is to try and express what we all feel, not to tell people how to feel. Not as a preacher, not as a leader, but as a reflection of us all. And it's like, that's the job of the artist in society, they're not some alienated being living on the outskirts of town. It's fine to live on the outskirts of town, but artists must reflect what we all are. That's what it's about, artists, or poets, or whatever you want to call it. And that's what I'm trying to express on behalf of all the men to all the women. Through my own feelings about women, when it dawned on me, you know, my God, it is the other half of the sky, as the late great Chairman McDougall said, right? I mean, they are the other half of the sky, and without them there is nothing. And without us there's nothing. There's only the two together, creates children, creates society. So what's all this BS about, you know, women are this and men are that? We're all human, man. We're all human. The beginning of Mother, the Plastic Ono album, you hear this litany, you know, very slow church bell, which is like a death knell, you know, I don't believe in, and the Freudian things about mother and father. And that was a kind of negative positive. I was trying to make a positive out of a negative, but it was heavy going. And the reason this one goes ting, 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 is to show that I've come through. And whoever's listening must have come through, or they wouldn't be here. And that's because I always consider my work one piece, whether it be with Beatles, David Bowie, Elton John, Yoko Ono, and I consider that my work won't be finished until I'm dead and buried, and I hope that's a long, long time. So to me, it's part of one whole piece of work from the time I became public to now. And that's the connecting point between that. And the 80s is like we got a new chance, you know?
Hi, this is Julia.
Welcome to my game. knows? There are no unwinnable wars. There are no unrightable wrongs or unsinkable song. There are no unbeatable odds. There are no believable gods. There are no unnameable names. Shall I say it again? Yeah. I don't ask much, I just want you. I just want you.
Rock and roll has been more important than John Lennon. With Paul McCartney, he wrote some of the most popular songs of all time. With the Beatles, he changed music forever. John Lennon was creatively fearless. He risked his popularity again and again to grow as an artist, a political voice, and a man. He was a husband who kept his marriage together when the whole world seemed to be against it. He was a father who gave up his public life to be with his child. John Lennon is a legend. This is his story. John Winston Lennon was born on October 9, 1940, in Liverpool, England. From the very beginning, his world was torn by strife on all sides. Liverpool lived under the threat of bombardment from Hitler's Air Force, and John's family was in turmoil. John's father, Fred, was a merchant seaman. Before John was two, his father disappeared. When John was five, his father returned. The little boy was asked to choose between his parents. John picked his mother, and Fred vanished again. After his father left, John's mother Julia moved in with a boyfriend and left John to his Aunt Mimi and Uncle George. Although John enjoyed a stable home life with his aunt and uncle, he would always feel the loss of his parents and the hunger to rebuild his family. Aunt Mimi and Uncle George raised John as if he were their own. Under their loving care, the boy blossomed. At age seven, he began to write and illustrate his own books. His drawings and stories combined the whimsy of Lewis Carroll with the sly humor of James Thurber. John loved art and literature, but he was bored by school and frequently got in trouble. At age 14, John suffered another loss when his Uncle George died suddenly. As John grew older, his mother Julia re-entered his life. Julia was a bohemian, a free spirit, and a huge influence on John.
She taught me music. She first of all taught me the banjo, and from that I progressed to guitar. And then unfortunately she was run over by an off-duty policeman who was drunk at the time. And it's very hard for me at that time, and I really had a chip on my shoulder.
John was devastated. He developed a tough facade and lacerating wit, which prevented anyone from getting too close. He was preordained to follow in the footsteps of his famous father, John Lennon.
It's like being the son of Christ or something. I mean, it's that crazy for a lot of people.
But Julian Lennon never truly knew the father who left him at age five.
Because I didn't know who he was, really, you know. And it was always very awkward whenever we saw each other.
As a teen, Julian made a heartfelt effort to forge a lasting relationship with his legendary dad. But it was cut short by John's tragic death.
He had to step over his father's blood. He had to step over the broken glass. What could he have felt?
But somehow, Julian emerged from the tragedy and captured the heart of the world with his own music.
Ever since you've been leaving me, I've been wanting to cry.
Julian's first record hit, and it hit big. And in an odd way, that may have been the worst thing that could have happened to him.
However, Julian's reign at the top was short-lived.
Hell, it wouldn't be right if I was more successful than Dad, would it? It shouldn't be allowed. That destroys people's dreams.
Everyone was greedy. For them, Julian was the golden goose. He was laying the eggs. They wanted more of them.
And if you go away, where am I to stay?
But in recent years, it's Julian who's been asking for more. He has repeatedly accused Yoko Ono of unfairly exploiting the Lennon legacy and hoarding the profits.
I mean, how much more does she want? She's got everything. She's raped and pillaged the Lennon family. That pisses me off.
Yet those familiar with Lennon family finances say Julian received a generous settlement.
It's more than fair. It's for an enormous amount of money.
From birth, he was destined to be famous, yet he was cursed to walk in the shadow of the father he never truly knew.
TV Raffles. first calls and then free cola. Dreaming of redemption, no end. To the living edit, the sound of amputation, or the centrifugal pull of an endless band. Until you shoot that rebel king down. There's a shimmering dark, seeing danger, what's at work here? The ingrowing twitch of faceless laughter, a cause without end to serve forever. The missionary madness of the sacrificial lamb. Until you shoot that rebel king down. Not until you shoot that rebel king down. Until you shoot that rebel king down. Not until you shoot that rebel king. On the heroes to whom it's written, not what he was, but what he should have been. But nothing you could do will change the circumstances, just a mildly furiation with statistics of sin. Until you shoot that rebel king down. Not until you shoot that rebel king down. Until you shoot that rebel king down. Not until you shoot that rebel king down.
Of hope and longing, a song of comfort and concern, written by Paul McCartney to console a 5-year-old boy devastated by his parents' divorce.
After the breakup, he was heading over to visit Mum and I. And it was a rainy, 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 grey day. And he just started thinking about the whole situation and how I was going to grow up and how I was going to deal with it.
That 5-year-old was Julian Lennon. As a young boy, Julian says he felt closer to Paul than he did to his own dad.
As a kid, I remember spending much more time playing with Paul, you know, playing cowboys and Indians with him. He always seemed very loving and very caring.
Hey Jude was Paul's way of helping Julian face the sadness that would echo throughout his life.
And with the sort of hope that maybe I'll pull through and make it okay, you know, one way or the other.
It's about Julian, about pain, about hanging on, about being strong.
For Julian, Hey Jude has been a beacon of light in the darkness, something to hold on to when everything else seemed lost.
And you can start to make it there.
He was the first Beatle baby, born in Liverpool to John and Cynthia Lennon on April 8, 1963. From the very beginning, Julian's dad was rarely at home. In fact, John didn't come to see his newborn son until several days after Julian was born. When he did meet his boy for the first time, John seemed certain about what the future held for baby Julian.
He picked him up, said, "Who's going to be a little rocker like his daddy?" I mean, he preordained what Julian was going to be.
When Julian's dad was home, Cynthia says he brought the chaos of the road with him. She says John frequently returned from Beatles recording sessions with hangers-on in tow.
There would be an entourage of the most nutty people you've ever imagined, because it was a party going on, because there were drugs, because there was all sorts of things happening. And Julian would wake up in the morning and the whole house would be littered with psychedelic bodies all over the floor, in the fridge, in the kitchen, in the garden. Confusing. It was confusing for me, never mind for a little boy.
Having a dad who was seldom home was hard on Julian, but according to Cynthia, having John back in the house after one of his frequent tours wasn't so easy on the youngster either.
He wouldn't get up until 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so the house had to be silent. And Julian would be desperate to take the newspaper up to him, and I'd say, "No, you can't, because Daddy's asleep." So he'd have to wait until 2 o'clock in the afternoon to creep along the landing to take his daddy the newspaper, not knowing whether Daddy would be in a good frame of mind or not.
By the time Julian was 3, Cynthia and John were growing apart. It was clear that John was becoming deeply involved with experimental artist Yoko Ono. Julian could only look on helplessly as his parents' marriage fell apart. He was just 5 years old when John and Cynthia divorced in 1968. Julian says that he remembers almost nothing about the traumatic breakup of his family or his father's abandonment.
I think it was blocked out because, I mean, Mum has told me there were times, especially after Dad left, that that I was screaming and shouting about where Dad was and what was going on. But I have no recollection whatsoever of that.
In March of 1969, John Lennon married Yoko Ono and moved to the English countryside. Cynthia and Julian carried on with their shattered lives as best they could. But being the child of a Beatle meant that Julian couldn't just quietly blend in with his schoolmates.
The headmaster would get up and would say, "And this term we have some new boys in school, and here's one of them. He's Julian Lennon, the son of John Lennon from the Beatles." So The way I was looked at or treated was always different from that point on. It was not just being a normal kid.
As Julian grew older, he saw less and less of his father. In 1970, Cynthia married restaurateur Roberto Bassanini. Finally, Julian says he had a father figure he could depend on. After that, he saw his real dad only on rare occasions.
But it was always very difficult and distant. Because I didn't know who he was, really. You know, he wasn't around.
And I'd also, you know, had someone had replaced him in my life, my stepfather, Roberto. You know, so I had Roberto as what I felt was my true father figure, you know. And then this guy that was really my father, who I hardly saw, was always very awkward whenever we saw each other.
Though Julian and his father weren't close, he still looked on with a heavy heart when John and Yoko left England for New York City in 1971. 8-year-old Julian didn't see his dad for the next 4 years.
Mum actually picked the phone up and said, "Look, you've got a son here. You've got responsibility here. How dare you just get up and leave and not even think about him?" And so we were on the phone a little bit every once in a blue moon, and then eventually got over there to the States to see him a couple of times.
By the late 70s, Julian's relationship with his father was slowly beginning to improve. During his visits to John's New York home in the famous Dakota Building, teenage Julian got to know his half-brother Sean, born in 1975. Yet even though Julian was John's firstborn son, he always felt like second best.
I didn't know how to react with him. He didn't know how to react with me. Still couldn't, you know. And it was interesting to see him and Sean, you know, to be able to walk into the Dakota and see Sean in a room the size of a house with more toys than you can ever imagine. And also the attention that he was getting. I mean, that was tough.
Sometimes our emotions make it hard for us to see that at the heart of loving is respect and honesty.
Growing up, Julian Lennon rarely saw his famous rock star dad, especially after John married Yoko Ono and moved to New York City. In the late 70s, Julian looked on in dismay as John took a 5-year break from music to give his second son, Sean, a proper upbringing.
You know, taking time off for Sean when he was born, that was going, well, that's frustrating a little bit. Why couldn't that have happened with me?
Belatedly, John began to reach out to his oldest son. Between 75 and 79, Julian was invited to the States several times to visit his famous dad.
It was very difficult for both of them. But then John started to invite Julian over to America. You know, he'd go and visit and they'd have fun.
But the fun didn't always last. According to Cynthia and Julian, the private John had a much darker and more aggressive side.
They both turned up to breakfast with no clothes on. And Julian, being a giggly little boy, which he always was, giggled. Because you suddenly see your father and his wife, you know, starkers. He'd never seen that before. So he giggled and he got really berated by John. And he stopped laughing. He stopped giggling. He stopped being happy boy.
And there were a couple of times where he lashed out, you like you wouldn't believe it. And told me to, like, stop laughing, never to laugh again.
By the end of the 70s, Julian developed an avid interest in music. It was a common bond between father and son in their transatlantic telephone calls. Yet even though their relationship was developing, Julian says he hadn't yet forgiven his father for abandoning him.
Why couldn't he have recognized this and tried to make things better, try to change things in regards to his love or respect for me? And I just don't understand, with a man of this much intelligence, knowledge, and love, sometimes, for the world, but not necessarily his family, for a long time, obviously, why did he not figure it out that maybe he should play some catch-up with me?
Stay tuned for more of Something Wicked with your guide into the night, Julia Queen Claus.
And by lately, you know, the Wheel Shop, Buzz's Place. Still on McDowell, just east of 16th Street, the Wheel Shop is Phoenix's oldest custom bike builders for over 25 years. It's your headquarters for parts, service, and all accessories. We have tires for all makes and models, Honda, Kawasaki, Suzuki, and of course, Harley-Davidson. Our technicians will mount and balance most models while you wait, and always free of charge. But if you want to discover our specialty and you still run spokes, lacing and truing are available. Customize your ride made to order. Want to trade it, upgrade it, or parade it? We'll help you make the deal. Want some leather for your lady, your man, your mother? Make the Wheel Shop your first stop on every run. But before you come, check your rubber. Look a little used? Tread carefully, because storms are a-brewing. The Wheel Shop, 253-1344. That's 253-1344.
Hi, this is Buzz. Hey, if you're not on our tires and wheels, please, please slow down.
What's the buzz? If you ride a scooter and run with the wind, keep tuned to the Buzz Run. Something Wicked brings you the rides, the rallies, and all the info on the next swap meet, or the wife's swap meet. The Wheel Shop in McDowell is the Buzz headquarters. I don't know how much head costs these days, but bring plenty of quarters. Call 253-1344 and ask before you come. Check your rubber. If it looks used, don't get caught in a shower. Wearing a raincoat with a new rubber between your legs is better than catching a nasty case of road rash. For most of you, we'll mount and balance you right there in the shop. What a freebie. Bring your wife and we'll mount her too. If she ain't balanced though, that's your problem. Oh, and your bike too. Most makes and models, but call 253-1344 and ask first. Buzz will be signing autographs, so if you have lived your life hoping to catch the elusive Buzz, stop by, shake his hand, and win a Harley or something. Maybe a pen. On a poker run, stop by and we'll give you the card you need. The next big run is Buzz's own creation.
Hi, this is Buzz. The run meets at the Wheel Shop, and from there we'll go to the bar.
Buzz will meet you at the bar.
KFNX and Renaissance Radio now bring you live proof the freaks really do come out at night as our newest late-night hostess, Julia, the Queen of Clubs, cordially invites and requests the presence of the people of Earth for pure madness and mayhem as we present Something Wicked every Friday night from 1:30 a.m. to 2:30 a.m. If you're a freak, a tweak, a geek, or just seek recognition like a Jerry Springer guest, here's your chance to call in and let the chairs fly. Julia, the Queen of Clubs, makes Jerry Springer look like a nationally successful talk show host. So call Julia every Friday night and let the Queen of Clubs go to bat for you.
Hi, this is Julia, the Queen of Clubs. Enter my chamber every Friday night, if you dare. Don't make me come make you.
That's Something Wicked every Friday night in conjunction with Yes We See Entertainment, bringing you a twisted approach to straight and alternative lifestyles. For less information, call the Queen of Clubs at 602-440-4001. That's 602-440-4001. And get a free tarot card reading every Friday night between 1:30 and 2:30 a.m. Something Wicked, only on Renaissance Radio, KFNX, 1100 a.m., Phoenix, Cave Creek.
Yes We See Entertainment, in conjunction with Last Call Phone Cards, is proud to bring you Something Wicked every Friday night at 1:30 a.m. Tune in as Julia, the Queen of Clubs, takes you to the other side of midnight. You are invited to run with us after hours into the madness of the night. Tune in to KFNX 1100 a.m. Renaissance Radio for Julia, the Queen of Clubs, and Something Wicked.
By late 1979, it seemed that perhaps finally father and son were going to move beyond the hurt and anger of the past and forge the relationship that each so desperately wanted.
Yeah, there was a hint that we were getting closer. Mm.
But John Lennon was on an irreversible collision course with history. On the evening of December 8th, 1980, 17-year-old Julian Lennon went to bed at his home in the north of Wales, only to be startled out of a deep sleep in the middle of the night.
I woke up and felt that there was something wrong. And couldn't put my finger on it, but felt something was bad. Something had happened.
When Julian went downstairs that morning, the house was dark and quiet. Julian tried desperately to calm his growing fears.
All the curtains were drawn in the house. And I looked out and I saw hundreds, if not thousands, of cameramen, reporters, you name it, photographers.
At the time, Cynthia was in London visiting Maureen Starkey, ex-wife of Ringo Starr.
About 3 or 4 in the morning, Maureen comes screaming up the stairs, saying John's been shot.
Back in Wales, Julian's stepdad told him the grim news. A deranged fan named Mark David Chapman had murdered his father in cold blood as John returned to the Dakota building after a long night of recording. Horrified by the news of his father's death, Julian at first refused to believe it.
Tell me, is this really happening? You know, because it was just too whacked out to, you know, seem real to me. I ranted and raved a little bit. Many tears came out.
In a state of shock, Cynthia rushed home to be with Julian.
It was just so horrific. And Julian came and sat on my knee and we both sobbed. You know, it's simple as that.
Though he was devastated, Julian made a brave and emotionally wrenching decision. He would go to New York alone and pay his respects to his fallen father.
I felt I had to go to New York to see it for myself. You know, I had to witness it to understand what had happened.
A few hours later, 17-year-old Julian boarded a flight to America without his mother. In New York, the scene was bedlam.
Yo!
When a distraught Julian arrived at the Dakota Building, he was faced with swarming media and an indescribable scene of mourning.
To enter the building, he has to step over the area, which was still a crime scene, meaning it was preserved by the police. He had to step over his father's blood. He had to step over the broken glass. He had to hear the sounds of thousands of children singing his father's songs outside. In this uncontrollable, traumatic, emotional state, what could he have felt? I mean, my heart just went out to him.
I remember arriving at the Dakota, and a lot of the people that were working for Dad and Yoko at that time were warning me, saying, be very careful of what might happen to his memory, his estate, etc., etc., etc. And then eventually I got to see her, and she wanted to take me down to see his body. And I said, no thanks, I don't want to do that. And then she showed me what happened, where it happened, which was pretty weird. And then the last thing I remember at that point in time was she had his cremated, you know, ashes in an urn on the mantelpiece in her bedroom, which was still warm. That was even stranger.
If she said to him, do you want to see the body? If she said to him, do you want to see the place where he was shot? I could picture Yoko just wanting to share, just wanting to be honest. And of course, if Julian was offended, I'm sorry he was. We were all offended, but it had little to do with protocol and a great deal to do with bullets.
The following weeks passed in a haze of grief and sadness. The world mourned John's passing along with Julian, but perhaps no one felt John's absence as much as the son who had never gotten to know him.
He was no longer innocent, and life would never be the way it once was, and whatever the dreams may have been to form a union between father and son could never be.
You won't die.
In December of 1980, the violent death of John Lennon cast a dark shadow over the world. His murderer, a Disturbed fan named Mark David Chapman, was arrested and given a prison sentence of 20 years to life. But the grief triggered by John's death would never be forgotten, and the echoes of the tragedy would resonate for years to come, especially in the life of John's sensitive firstborn son, Julian.
When we lost John, Julian suddenly got granny glasses and let his hair grow, because that's an identity crisis. He didn't know where on earth he was going, what he was doing, or anything.
Stay tuned for more of Something Wicked with your guide into the night, Julia, Queen of Clubs.
Looking past the lying bed,
During his travels, Julian's thoughts often returned to memories of his father. He was still tormented by the difference between the all-you-need-is-love rhetoric John used in public and the way Julian says he actually conducted himself in private.
How can you go forward publicly and talk about peace and love when you can't even keep it stable at home? And you do the things you do at home, which is leave your wife and go off with someone else. And then don't pay attention to your kid for years and years. That ain't saintly. You know? I mean, that hurts a great deal. And trying to find forgiveness for that is very difficult.
Here's the situation in the town hall balcony. It's absolutely magnificent. Can we have a little quiet, please? Would you like the boys to talk to you and say a few words, if it's possible? A police officer said here a moment there'd be at least 30,000 people in front of the town hall area. This is something that's never been seen in Adelaide before. It's absolutely magnificent. Can we have a little bit of quiet, please, and we can talk to each one? What can I say? Quiet, please.
Now, draw! Oh, you got me!
Let me see. We'll be right back. forever trusting, raised in a form of living hell. When your trauma breaks, live and die within your heart. So beware the shadows, your family tree waits in the dark. I say, I know they were doing it.